closer.
Radiofonica.com.
And welcome to Short Science, your international era-spanning portal for all the very best science in brief. I'm Elizabeth Hawke, and today the show is being taken over by Thea Cunningham, Camilla Ruse and Chloe McIver, and they're going to be talking all about the Big Fish Fight campaign for sustainable fishing. We're also going to be hearing from Ed Prosser and Katie Draper as they tackle the next episode of The Sounds of Science, looking at a bit of the science behind echolocation. This is Short Science. So, welcome to the show, and as we've just said, today the show is being taken over by Thea, Camilla and Chloe. So, ladies, introduce yourselves and tell us what we can expect in the show today.
Hi, I'm Thea. I'm currently doing the Science Communication course here at Imperial. This is my third time on Short Science. I presented two shows last year on sensors, and the other one was on the Cancun Climate Conference, so it's great to be back in the studio again.
Hi, I'm Camilla. I'm also an Imperial Science Communication student, and I helped co-present the Cancun Conference with Thea in December.
Hi, I'm Chloe. I'm another Science Communication student, and this is my second time on Short Science. Inspired by the recent Big Fish Fight campaign on Channel 4, we're going to be looking into where the EU currently stands on their fisheries policy and how the campaign aims to help. We will also be taking a look at what we can do to make sure we're doing what we can to support sustainable fishing.
Plus, we'll be listening to the latest Sounds of Science episode by Ed Prosser and Katie Draper.
Great stuff. So I really can't wait for the rest of the show to find out a bit more about all this policy on fish and fisheries. Well, I'm going to take the opportunity to tell you a little bit about next week's show now. So next week, we are going to be looking at space exploration. We're going to be looking at details of what's been found on the moon, our missions to the moon, and also missions to other planets and exploration in space. So we want to know what you think. Is space exploration good value for money? Is it something we should be doing? Is it important? Should we be looking at planets in our solar system or looking in galaxies further afield? Now, if you want to take part in the show, just call into our recording service on +44 7401 856 681. That's 07401 856 681, and we'll play out your message live on air. Alternatively, you can get in touch via email. That's studio@shortscience.co.uk. And check out our website, shortscience.co.uk, for more information on today's show and next week's show. Right now, it's time for the Short Science News in Brief.
Okay, first up, birds living around Chernobyl have smaller brains, scientists have discovered. The study claims that the effect is directly linked to the lingering background radiation in the area. The researchers used mist nets to collect over 500 birds from woodland sites around Chernobyl. After controlling for differences between species, the team discovered that the brains of birds were 5% smaller than normal. Smaller brain sizes are thought to be linked to reduced cognitive ability. The effect was also worse in younger birds, particularly those less than a year old. This suggests that many bird embryos may not be surviving at all due to the negative effects that the radiation has on developing brains.
It turns out that our ancestors quite literally outran the Neanderthals. According to a study published in the most recent issue of the Journal of Human Evolution, Neanderthals were much weaker runners than Homo sapiens, and it's thought that this could have influenced their extinction. So how can we tell how fast the Neanderthals were? Apparently the Achilles tendon holds the answer. Tendons act like springs when you run, and so the more energy stored in the spring, the more efficient you will be as a runner. Researchers from the University of Arizona measured the distance between the two points in the heel where the Achilles tendon attaches and compared these measurements in 8 long-distance runners. They found that the shorter the distance, the more energy stored in the tendon, and so the better the runner. Applying this to Neanderthal skeletons, it becomes apparent that this distance was much longer in the Neanderthals, and they were therefore likely to be less efficient runners.
New research has linked an enzyme in the retina to a leading cause of blindness. Researchers at the University of Kentucky have shown an enzyme called DICER1 is less active in the retina of patients suffering from age-related macular degeneration, or AMD. AMD is an incurable condition affecting approximately 500,000 people in the UK and causes a decline in the sufferer's central vision, making it difficult for them to read, drive, and recognise people. When the team switched off the gene that produces DICER1 in mice, the mouse's retinal cells became damaged. They discovered a lack of DICER1 caused tiny pieces of a poisonous genetic material called ALU RNA to build up, killing the cells in the retina. The team hope the results will pave the way for new treatments to tackle the condition.
Scientists have discovered a new malarial mosquito. A subgroup of Anopheles gambiae, the insect species already responsible for most of the malaria transmission in Africa, the discovery raises serious concerns in the war against the disease. The mosquito has evaded classification until now because it rests away from human dwellings, where most scientific attention has been focused. The researchers report that the new subgroup could have evolved quite recently and say that further investigation is needed to understand the consequences of the discovery for malarial control.
Also this week, researchers at the University of California have developed a new type of shock absorber to help protect flight recorders during a plane crash. The technology was inspired by the head of the golden-fronted woodpecker. A woodpecker drumming on a tree copes with approximately 12 times the mechanical shock that would ordinarily concuss a human. Investigations into the head and the neck of the bird revealed four structures that make this possible. It was then a matter of finding ways to replicate these structures in order to protect microelectronics.
And last but not least, scientists have created a postcode map of allergies across the UK in an attempt to trace allergy hotspots. Allergies affect more than 20 million people living in the UK, but until now, very little research has been carried out into how they differ according to geographical area. Researchers at the University of Plymouth examined just under 6,000 patients referred from over 600 practices in Devon and Cornwall over the last 11 years, along with population data, morbidity statistics, and consultants' letters. Their results revealed airborne allergies are clustered in North Dartmoor and Exmoor, whereas food allergies are more common in the South Hams. Southwest Cornwall was found to be a major hotspot for seafood allergies. The findings should help scientists to cross-reference allergies according to a wider range of demographics.
Great stuff. Some really interesting news there today. Well, it's time now for our first capsule.
So, Thea, where do we currently stand with policy on fisheries?
The fisheries across Europe are all managed through what's known as the Common Fisheries Policy, which was established to maintain a sustainable fishing industry across the EU. So this means that European countries manage their fisheries together, which was seen as a sensible thing to do since the activity of one fishing fleet often directly affects the opportunities of another.
Didn't it undergo a reform back a few years ago?
Yes, it did. There was a reform back in 2002, and some good things did come out of it, namely the ability of stakeholders to become more involved in influencing policy. There's also been progress made towards more long-term approaches to managing fish stocks, but these advantages have been somewhat overshadowed by its failures.
Can you explain what these are?
Well, one of the main problems is a vicious circle that runs right at the heart of the fisheries industry, and it involves technology and stock. New technologies have meant bigger, better boats. Now, whilst these may seem great because they have bigger harvesting capacities, it does mean we slowly lose control over the size of fleets. In the past, the EU has subsidised fishing capacity and helped the European fleet modernise, but as a result, the fleets have outgrown the stocks and the stocks have begun to deplete. So the fewer fish there are left to catch, the smaller the industry's profit margins become. So fishers try to fish even more to make up for the loss of earnings, and this means the policy ends up subsidising even more and so on. So it's become a cycle that's quite hard to put a halt on.
What's been the response to this?
Well, the European Commission has launched a review of the policy by calling for a debate between member states, stakeholders and the general public. So they've set out a lot of questions which they've put forward in what's known as the Green Paper, which was published back in 2009. And this basically set out an optimistic vision for the future of the fisheries sector in the EU. And they made it clear that nothing was immune to debate, so no topic is a no-go zone, which has set the bar high for some potentially promising policies.
What areas is it focusing on?
The major focus is on ecological sustainability. So they're looking at how we can remove overcapacity in the fishing fleets and hence stop overfishing, looking at how we can make sure the policy works towards protecting the marine environment and seeing how we can adapt fleet capacity, but at the same time settling social concerns faced by coastal communities. And the review is really important since Europe now relies on imports for two-thirds of its fish because of our overfishing. So it really needs to work on reducing overcapacity so that stocks aren't depleted and this vicious circle can be stopped. And it also hopefully sets some aims for management plans that should set a maximum sustainable fishing yield for fisheries. The industry needs to be more accountable for its actions and for helping keep stocks of EU fish healthy. So also to encourage fisheries ministers to focus on the common good rather than on their immediate share and make it a cooperative goal to work together. The review will also address fish discard and how to decrease this as well. So we'll be chatting about that in just a sec. So fingers crossed, the reform should have some positive outcomes on all these shortcomings.
A great overview there from Thea. So now let's have a little bit more detail about the Fish Fight campaign.
So what was the Fish Fight campaign?
Well, you might have seen the TV programmes that went with it on Channel 4 a few weeks ago. They featured Chef Hugh Fernley Whittingstall, as well as Heston Bloomingtall, Jamie Oliver, Gordon Ramsay, and they're all campaigning to end the practice of discard in commercial fishing operations.
Could you give us a rundown of what exactly discard is?
Sure. Discard is a term used for dead or dying fish that are returned to the sea by fishing boats. In the EU, fishermen are not allowed to land more than their quota of fish. So if they catch any accidentally, they're not allowed to bring them back to land. So they just have to throw them back in. And it's an actual offence to have these extra fish on board when you dock. So the fishermen really don't have a choice.
Do they know how many fish are discarded a year?
Well, they've done several studies into it. And the current estimate is that, and this is in the North Sea alone, that almost 1 million tonnes of dead fish are thrown back into the sea every year.
That's such a waste.
Yeah, it really is. And most of the fish that are thrown away are perfectly edible. So not only are fish being killed for no good reason, but it's a completely needless waste of food. And it also has an impact on the animals that scavenge off the remains of the fish thrown overboard, because it messes up their natural food chains.
So how does the Big Fish Fight campaign aim to help?
Well, it's really been about bringing the issue to the attention of the public. So they have used a group of top chefs to front the campaign, and it's been turned into a TV series. Then they've also had huge amounts of celebrity endorsement from people like Stephen Fry, Ricky Gervais, Jeremy Paxman, and many others. Basically, the campaign is trying to make fish discard into an issue that our government and the EU Commission can no longer afford to ignore.
Are there any industry groups supporting the campaign as well? Because that would be an important way of adding pressure to the government.
Yes, they have. In fact, what the campaign has been best at has been getting support from a really wide range of people. So apart from public figures and the media, they've got some huge supermarkets supporting the campaign, like Sainsbury's, Marks and Spencer's, and also a long list of NGOs like the WWF, Greenpeace and the Marine Conservation Society.
So has the EU Commission responded to the campaign?
Yeah, they have, and they've actually responded really positively to it. In fact, last week, the EU Fisheries Commissioner pledged to end what she called the nightmare of discards, and she said that she was confident the proposals to end the practice would go ahead because of the high level of public support.
Which goes to show how effective the campaign has been.
Yeah, exactly. Her statement is basically a response to the huge amount of support from the public and the high level of media attention that the issue has been getting, which is exactly what the Fish Fight campaign was hoping to do.
We haven't touched on any solutions to the problem of discard yet. I know the campaign has been more to do with raising attention, but do they also have ideas on how we can make fishing more sustainable?
Well, the Fish Fight campaign is focusing on two solutions, and the first is getting the EU policy changed into one that protects fish stocks and also works for fishermen and consumers. But the campaign doesn't endorse any particular policy idea, and they think that any new agreements will need to be a combination of different ideas and strategies. The second solution is getting us to diversify our fish-eating habits so that there is a greater demand for a greater variety of the fish species that are caught.
Great stuff there. So if you did happen to miss the great fish fight on TV, you've got the basics there of what it was trying to achieve. Well, it's time now for our final capsule of the day.
Next up, Chloe's going to run us through what we can do to help. So Chloe, can you tell us which types of fish we should be avoiding?
Some types of fish are best to avoid at all costs, shark and skate being prime examples. However, when it comes to the country's most popular fish, things become a bit more complicated. It's important to consider the fishing methods used as well as the ecological state of the fish population. In his latest book, Hugh Fernley Whittingstall includes a list of the top 10 fish to avoid. Top of the list is the country's chip shop's favourite, cod.
What are the main problems with eating cod? Can you run us through those?
Well, the main issue is simply a numbers game. The sheer quantity of cod consumed in the UK is so great that the majority of it has to be imported from Norway, Iceland and Russia. A few years ago, it was well known that there was a shortage of cod due to intensive fishing habits, and the EU recently cut the 2011 North Sea cod quotas by an additional 20%. Though not all cod is unsustainable, and it just means that we have to be a bit more clued up about when it comes to supermarket labels. It's generally best to judge by fishery rather than entire species. The Marine Conservation Society recommends line caught cod as the most sustainable choice, which tends to mean buying Atlantic cod from the Northeast Arctic or Pacific cod.
And what about kind of other popular choices such as tuna? Does the same apply?
In the UK, we buy more tuna than any other fish, equating to over 30 Olympic swimming pools in volume. But the story regarding the sustainability of these fish is complicated. Bluefin tuna has been overfished to almost complete extinction, but the tuna that you find in most supermarket cans is skipjack tuna, the stocks of which are healthy. Although skipjack numbers are not currently under threat, there are still problems with such a high consumer demand for these fish. That is the impact of the fishing methods on other marine life, such as turtles and sharks. The most sustainable tuna to look out for in the supermarket is pole and line caught fish from the Maldives or albacore tuna from the Pacific. Continuing on this cautionary note, salmon is another British favourite that deserves our concern. Wild salmon should certainly be avoided, but farmed salmon is a much more contentious issue. It's been long debated whether it's possible for fish farming to be sustainable, but the Marine Conservation Society currently recommends buying organic Atlantic salmon.
And finally, are there any species of fish that are completely guilt-free?
It's generally recommended that we eat more UK landed fish, and there are varieties that we could eat more of to help take the pressure off threatened species. And one of the main aims of the fish fight is to get us to diversify our fish eating habits. Some sustainable fish to try include mackerel, pollock, Cornish sardines, mullet and coley. Also, shellfish is a pretty good bet when trying to shop sustainably, especially mussels, scallops, oysters and squid. It is, however, difficult, if not impossible, to come up with a definitive list, as it's likely to change from review to review. Therefore, if you're concerned about the fish you're buying, it's best to check online at www.fishonline.org, which is a website run by the Marine Conservation Society. You can just type in a species of fish and it will give you a sustainability rating for that fish. If you missed any of Channel 4's fish fight programmes, then you can still catch them on 4AD. Also, if you're wondering how to make the most of any of the lesser known marine delicacies, the Channel 4 website also has a wide selection of recipes to try. And finally, don't forget to sign the Fish Fight petition at www.fishfight.net.
Well, thanks very much, girls. That's a really good overall update on the fishing situation and what we can do as consumers in the supermarket to try and help protect the sustainability of fish in our waters. So I'll just give you those website addresses again. If you're buying a fish in the supermarket and you're worried about whether it's a sustainable type of fish or whether it's a fish that you should indeed be buying and eating at all, the website you need to check out is www.fishonline.org, and that website is run by the Marine Conservation Society. We'll put a link to that on our website. And the other website to check out is www.fishfight.net, where you can sign the petition that was mentioned in the Fish Fight programmes on Channel 4. So, girls, what's coming up next on the show?
Now, just before the quiz, we're going to listen to some sounds of science. This week, Ed and Katie are at the Zoological Society of London, finding out what echolocation has to do with conservation.
Hello, and welcome to the Sounds of Science. This week, echolocation, bats, neural networks, and smartphones. I'm referring to some of the exciting work being carried out at the Zoology Society of London. Echolocation is a type of biological sonar which allows animals such as dolphins and bats to see with sound, which is a really useful adaptation because it allows them to exist in a nocturnal niche where there is often reduced competition and an abundance of insects. EchoBank is a bat call reference library which is being compiled by scientists to help identify bats from the acoustic properties of their calls. Individual bat species echolocate within specific frequency ranges, which are specific to their environments and prey type. In combination with a neural network, the reference library is being used to identify bat species from recorded samples.
So I went down to the Zoological Society of London to find out a little bit more.
I'm Kate Jones. I'm a biodiversity scientist here at the Zoological Society of London.
I'm Alana Maltby. I'm a final year PhD student at the Institute of Zoology and UCL.
I'm Charlotte Waters. I'm a second year PhD student at the Institute of Zoology and Kent University.
So perhaps you could tell me a little about the EchoBank reference library you've been building.
The idea of EchoBank is just to collect as many recordings as we can of any species of bat that echolocates. So it's a bit like a collection of bird recordings. In EchoBank at the moment we have about 325 species worth of calls, which is a third of all echolocating bats. So there's quite a lot of applications for it. You could just use it just to understand more about how echolocation works in the first place, and I'm using it to try and understand how echolocation evolved.
So what are the specific acoustic properties you analyse in a bat call?
We tend to look at the frequencies in the call and things like the call duration, kind of get these parameters. So we take maybe five parameters of the maximum, minimum frequency, the peak frequency, which is the frequency where the call is loudest, and the duration of the call. And then we can use these parameters to try and identify the species. So for an EchoBank, all the species are known because the bat is caught or identified, so we know what species they are. So then if we record a bat and we don't know the species, we can use these parameters that we've measured from the calls to compare it with the parameters of the calls in EchoBank to identify the species. And I'm developing a neural network method, which is an automatic method of doing that.
And how would you train the network to do this?
It trains itself in very complicated ways. And it does take a long time because there's not just one way of training a network. You don't train the whole network on all the species. You separate it up into smaller chunks. So you might separate up into groups of species that are more similar. And each network that you train, it does about 3,000 different iterations of different ways it can be trained. Because each network might be slightly different and better at identifying different species. And then they all vote at which species they think it is. So it works as an ensemble.
Once you sort of Clayton created this library, what applications does that have, I suppose, on research?
I'm using it to train this network so we can identify species. And then what we can use that for is, so I need to collect distribution data from bats from all over Europe to look at things like habitat associations and climate associations of different species. With future global climate change and land use change, to look at predicting how species distributions might change. And that will inform conservation planning. In order to be able to get all this distribution data, we need a way of identifying bats so we can find where they are. So we use bat detectors, and then we can use this EchoBank to help identify the bats we find so we can get this occurrence data to make distribution models.
So how can this EchoBank and neural network be used in conservation research?
I've kind of integrated these approaches into a conservation programme. So I'm using the kind of occurrence and decline of bat populations as a heart monitor for the environment. So they're indicator species. The program is called IBATS and is Indicator Bats Program. And what we've done is provided the first kind of protocols to give out so people can around the world can do the same kind of monitoring. So they're monitoring their populations where they live. So we started off in the heart of Transylvania when we first started this project, often Romania, as a kind of pilot, and then we've spread it across the regions, and now we're in over 14 countries. So the idea is to build local biodiversity networks, so getting local people involved and giving them training, and then we give them lend them the equipment so that they can drive around their area and monitor their own bats. But what we provide is a kind of website so that they can upload their data that they've got, and we give them the tools and with which to analyse their data. So, you know, in the future we will be implementing the algorithms which Charlotte is putting together, and the data from EchoBank that Alana has put together, so that we can get a better accuracy on identification. So the biggest improvement that we're working on right now, instead of having a separate recording device and a GPS, we're integrating them into a smartphone and having a smartphone application. You just have the bat detector microphone attached to an iPhone or a Google phone, and then we have developed or are developing these apps which the user can just open and press go, and then they record it onto the device and then send it to the website. It's a very standardised approach that anyone can get involved with. And then the interaction comes with the website and, you know, Facebook and Twitter, so that they can actually participate in the project and see their results. But to get it standardised, I think, and simple, is the key to get to start to monitor biodiversity across the planet.
Are bats a good indicator of the sort of state or health of the environment? Assuming this is what you're using this information as a marker for.
I think that's a very interesting question that we don't really know the answer to. And it's not just about bats, it's about any organism that someone picks as an indicator species. The problem with indicator species, focusing on just a few, might be that you're missing a huge swathe of biodiversity that's not being monitored. And bats are nocturnal, so they kind of represent nocturnal biodiversity. They're a fifth of all mammalian species, so they're quite a big proportion of mammals. They occur in all habitats apart from the poles. You can get them in Regent's Park, just over the road, and then in pristine rainforests. They cover a huge range of environments and habitats and biomes. They've got behaviours which are temperature dependent, so if the temperature changes, then they're going to change their behaviour.
With this digital infrastructure that you're creating, is there scope to apply it to other animals which can also be identified through sound?
Yeah, it could work in exactly the same way as what we're doing from the database, the digital infrastructure that we're building, to setting up neural networks, especially if there's more differences between calls between the species, and monitoring it long term.
Hypothetically talking a long time down the line, do you see sort of maybe a system where anyone in the world can take a recording, say on their smartphone, is run through this program, and they can get an identification of what that animal might be?
I mean, I think we're closer to that than you'd think. We don't need the internet. You could use your mobile device as a handheld computer. So as long as you've got the algorithms and you've got the processing power on the iPhone or the Google phone, we've already trained the networks. It would just look at those algorithms and give you a probability on screen with a picture.
If you want to find out more or are interested in getting involved in the IBATS monitoring program, go to www.ibats.org.uk. And I'll leave you with the sound of Myotis mistassinus, or the whiskered bat.
A brilliant episode of The Sounds of Science there from Ed Prosser and Katie Draper. If you want to find out more information about the Sounds of Science series, check out shortscience.co.uk for more information on Ed's work. Well, I think it's time now for this week's quiz.
Okay, I'm going to kick us off with the first question, and that is, because of overfishing, Europe now relies on imports for how much of its fish stock? Is it A, a third, or B, two-thirds?
two-thirds.
And Chloe, what's your guess?
I'll go for the other option then. Third.
Camilla is right. It is two-thirds. Two-thirds of our stock is actually from imports across Europe, which makes the fish fight campaign even more worthwhile.
Okay, I've got the next question. How many thousand fish are discarded every year? 500,000 to 600,000, 700,000 to 800,000, or 800,000 to 900,000?
I'm going to go with 800 to 900.
Yeah, I'd go for the same.
You're both right then. Well done.
The next question, which fish do we spend most on in the UK?
I'm going to go with cod just because it's one of the most popular. I don't know whether... Do you mean kind of the one that's bought most often or the one that's most expensive? Or I suppose that's part of the question.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, cod or maybe salmon.
I'm going to go for salmon because Thea's not allowed two answers.
Yeah, you're right, it's salmon. We spend 630 million on salmon every year, apparently.
Okay, I've got the next question. The percentage of stocks believed to be overfished is A, 40%, B, 60%, or C,
80%? 80%, I'm going to say.
Did you look at my sheet? Well, yeah, the answer is, in fact, C, 80%. Scientists consider a whopping 80% of stocks to be overfished, which makes Europe, shamefully, one of the worst cases worldwide.
Okay, I've got a question about the big fish fight campaign, which is how many people have signed up to the campaign so far? 640,000, 450,000, or 1 million?
640,000? Yeah, I'm going to go with 640, just because I checked the figure last night.
Well, you're both right, 640,000.
Okay, so I've got another question to do with how... to do with spending. How much is shark fins worth? How much would a fisherman get for a single fin?
That's a tough one. I should know this because I did watch the Gordon Ramsay shark bait program a few weeks ago. Have you got any options?
Yeah, I can give some options.
Okay.
A, £50, or B, £120, or C, £200.
This is for one fin?
Yeah.
120 is my guess.
200?
Yeah, it's 200.
Right, okay. Next question. True or false, Gordon Ramsay is in deep water, excuse the pun, after it has been transpired that only a year and a half before making a documentary that recently aired on Channel 4 about the shark fin trade, he himself had chartered a shark fishing boat.
True.
Is that true?
It is in fact true. Recent pictures published show Ramsay high-fiving the captain of a fishing boat off the coast of Florida after reeling in a 7-foot bull shark. He's since issued a letter saying he regrets his actions and no longer supports any form of shark fishing.
Next question.
Right, that's me again. Dab, flounder and megrim are all type of what fish? A, bottom-dwelling flatfish, or B, surface-dwelling fish?
Flatfish, I think.
I feel like I should know this because I did zoology, but I'm going to say bottom-dwelling fish.
Yeah, no, that, you're right. They are all bottom-dwelling flatfish, and there are three types of fish which the campaign is suggesting people try out because they're plentiful and caught easily around the British Isles. Apparently, megrim makes a particularly good alternative to plaise and Dover sole. Tastes just as good, stocks are in better shape, and it can be easily substituted in recipes for either. So get eating, guys.
Great stuff. Well, that's about all we have time for on the show today. So don't forget to call in and leave a message for next week's show. If you've got any thoughts about our exploration of the moon, other planets, or indeed beyond, call our recording service on +44 7401 856 681. That's 07401 856 681. You can also get in touch by email. The address is studio@shortscience.co.uk. And don't forget to check out our website to find out more details about how to listen to this show, subscribe to our podcast, and listen again to previous shows. The address for the website is shortscience.co.uk. Thanks ever so much for today's Takeover presenters, Chloe McIver, Thea Cunningham, and Camilla Ruse. Thanks to Ed Prosser and Katie Draper for The Sounds of Science. And thanks once again to James F. for his brilliant quiz jingle. My name is Elizabeth Hawke, and I have been your host for this very special episode of Short Science. I took care of the production here in the studio, and the theme tune was written and produced by Don Gould of Music by Design. Thanks very much for listening, and join us again next week for another episode of Short Science.
On of the night, love the way the light is filtering through, and hold by the half-word sunlight. Lie on the bed you hate to love, let your body roll right onto my side. Time has come to recognize that it's alright, so alright. Yes, it's alright for me. And it's alright, so alright. Always felt like heaven knows my name. My gaze right to the core. Feels like something's gonna turn. Wrong.
La migliore musica italiana in esclusiva.
Gli artisti emergenti più interessanti.
I live più adrenalinici.
La black music di Piotta.
Il music book di Dario Salvatori.
La musica al femminile di Note Rosa.
Videogames, animazione, cultura moderna.
Tutto questo e molto altro è Ubix, il miglior free press di musica e cultura in circolazione. Da gennaio Ubix arriva in Umbria. Cercalo ogni mese sul web e nelle migliori location della regione.
www.ubixweb.com.
Ubix.
Free press, free spirit, free music. Eden, la danza di un mondo perfetto. Eden, se il tuo sguardo dice ti aspetto. Se alla fine riusciremo a credere nelle nostre promesse, avremo pace e le risposte incognite, da sempre le stesse, per diventare adulti come nuove idee di un vecchio universo, per imparare ad affrontare il tempo noi in un mondo diverso. E dare un domicilio alle distanze del cuore in un giorno perfetto. Eden, sala danze, domenica aperto. Eden, il tuo passo che non è più incerto. Yeah.
Natali, passavo il Natale vestendomi uguale alla gente di là. Se la mosca ballavo la polca, due black odi contavo il tavolo zar. Se ero in Cina mangiavo involtini e friggevo di tutto, persino il caffè. In Giappone solo pesce crudo, lezioni di Giuda d'Amazzo Sake. E in ogni caserma avevo un amore, per ogni lanterna bruciava un nome. E in ogni caserma avevo un amore, per ogni lanterna bruciava un nome. In Alaska facevo la vasca segando una buona pavella di glu. Stavo in faccia con maglietta bianca, le scarpe però si pantaloni blu. In Inghilterra fermavo la guerra per 10 minuti nell'ora del tè. Alle fande dei chi mangiava sparavo già qua nell'ora del tè. E in ogni caserma avevo un amore, per ogni lanterna bruciava un nome. E in ogni caserma avevo un amore, per ogni lanterna bruciava un nome. Passavo il Natale così, se la mosca ballava la polca, gli stavo in Cina e friggevo in voltini caffè. In Giappone solo pesce crudo e caffè. In Alaska facevo vasche, in blu stavo in Francia di bianco, di rosso e di blu. In Inghilterra fermavo la guerra con te. Alle palle dei chili mangiavo con te, ma di notte sognavo l'Italia. La donna più vale, cavale e camale.